Hello, and welcome to Misspoken, a live lit show featuring essays by the female identified, exploring a new theme each month. This is Rosamund Lannan, and I host the show with Jasmine Davila. The following is a recording of our May 30th, 2018 show at the Gallery Cabaret. This month's theme was fangirl, or as we like to say, expert. This month, we had the chance to nerd out with Ann Abel, Keidra Chaney, Kathleen Rooney, Leanne Yopes, and Megan Kirby. Stay tuned for our next show on June 27th. The theme is Miss Manners. For more information, you can find us at miss-spoken.com. Hey guys, we're going to start the show. That's why we're talking up here. Yay! Woo!
All right, well, hello and welcome to Misspoken, a Lady Live Lit show featuring personal essays by female-identifying writers. We are your hosts, Jasmine Davila and Rosamund Lannan.
Hello, hi! You can find us here at the Gallery Cabaret the last Wednesday of the month. Each month we take... Hey, guys. Okay. I'm going to turn the lights on and off. Each month, we take on a new and exciting theme, and this month's theme is...
Fangirl.
Woo! So, it is also our fourth birthday. Woo! We are 4 years old as a series. We're in nursery school. Yay. We're definitely not a child prodigy. Mm-hmm. What else have we found out about ourselves? Do we play the violin?
Not yet.
No, but we're working on it. We're getting there.
Yeah.
So, this month, because it is our birthday, we're going to do a couple of special things. It'll be like the best conference you ever went to, with all the weird drunk stuff and none of the terrible panels.
Yeah.
Yay!
Just one excellent panel with a bunch of excellent people.
Yeah, just one really long panel.
It's gonna be awesome, but it's gonna be worth it.
Okay. wow, we're really selling this. So to start, you might have noticed on your table that there's this lanyard and a badge. You see that? Okay, cool. So on this badge, this is gonna come in handy later for a surprise. You're gonna take the badge, and on the front of it with our logo, with stickers that were printed by Minuteman Press in the West Loop, they did not donate, but they are a printing business, and that's tough. So Minuteman Press will do things within 36 hours. On this front half, you want to write your name. This is the most important part. Mm-hmm. And then if you feel like it, like any fandoms you're a part of. Like
if you're a Hiddlestoner or a Cumberbitch or...
Cumberbitch?
Yes.
Is that real?
Yes.
You just made that up.
No, I did not. Oh, no.
Weird.
You haven't been on Tumblr lately.
I have not been on Tumblr lately. Yeah. If you know any cute fan names for your fandom, oh my God, share them because we eat that shit up. So this is half one. Okay. Half two... This is going to come in handy later. Write down your most fandom moment. It could be like, for example, I hyperventilated when I met Phoebe Gleigner, author of Diary of a Teenage Girl. That was cool. Maybe you have a different one. Like maybe you waited in line for a really long time. What else can you do that's fandom-y?
Maybe you take a picture of the person that, you know, who's the object of your fandom and incorporate them into your Christmas card.
That's Jasmine. She did that.
No, I didn't. Like, I have a friend who did that.
It's not a friend. It was Jasmine. I left it up for 4 months. Or, I don't know, if you did something illegal, use your discretion, because this is going on iTunes. Just think about it. But yeah, do that. If you all could do that right now, we're going to give you like a minute to do it.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're just going to stand up here, get your lanyard. Mm-hmm.
They should... There are pens scattered around, like on the bar.
There's tables. Some pens up here.
Pens up here, too.
This is great. We can talk about cupcakes at intermission, I think.
Yeah,
let's do that at intermission.
Yeah.
It's not live? Maybe turned up?
I think turned up, maybe.
Can you guys hear us?
Yeah.
But it could be a little louder, right? Okay. Is that... That seems like
it's fine.
Okay, cool. All right, cool. All right.
All right, should we get going?
Let's give it like 10 more seconds.
Yeah.
Okay,
right,
cool. Oh, I need the bios.
No, wait, you have
oh my God, you're so smart. Okay, so smart.
So is that the first slide?
Yeah, that's
the first slide.
Okay, great. All right, while you guys are writing, we're going to get started. We're going to kick things off with Keidra Chaney. Keidra Chaney is a writer, publisher of the pop culture website The Learned Fangirl, a really excellent website with like really awesome but accessible academic stuff about fan culture, which is kind of what we all want. Oh, yeah, she's also an occasional rock musician. Give it up for Keidra!
Hey, Okay, let me turn this on. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
I'm Kedra. I'm going to semi-read, semi-riff. We'll see how it goes. My first concert, even though I don't actually remember it, was the Jackson's Victory Tour in 1984. And I'm super proud of that fact. I'm also very proud of the day that Ben Weinman, the guitarist of Dillinger Escape Plan, kicked me in the face at a South by Southwest show in 2010. And then I went back the next morning for another show at 7 a.m. I'm also super proud of the fact that last year I went to two different countries, Canada and Japan, to see the K-pop boy band SHINee before their upcoming hiatus. And this October will be the 22nd time that I've seen Nine Inch Nails live in the past 20 years. Yeah. My other favorite band, Dillinger Escape Plan, I've seen 17 times, maybe 18. I can't remember one of them. I was and am a music fangirl, and I'm here in my Dillinger Escape Plan shirt and my SHINee fan light stick to deliver a rant in support of music fangirls as a solely underrepresented and under-acknowledged subset within the fangirl kind. We're a group that's so marginalized and so underrepresented within fandom that not only are we not recognized or understood in the usual geeky fanish circles the way that comic book fans and sci-fi fangirls are, but even music fangirls don't even recognize ourselves in plain sight. I bring this up because, as was mentioned, I run a website called The Learned Fangirl for the past 10 years, and while I get asked to come to conferences to talk about different fan culture things, I so rarely get asked to talk about music, which is really my thing. I'll get asked to talk about, like, black women in sci-fi and comic book lore and all this stuff, speculative fiction. And I know a little bit about that stuff, but I know way more about heavy metal, and I know way more about K-pop, and I know way more about R&B, and I never get asked to do those things. And I kind of know why, but I also kind of know why not, for a bunch of reasons. But a couple years ago, I asked a friend of mine at C2E2, who is a geeky fangirl. We'd spent about a half an hour talking about all the times we had traveled to different countries. We had chased bands around. She was a, what are fish fans called? I don't remember. Anyone? Fish fans? Okay, I guess fish fans. I don't know. I thought they were, like, I don't know if they have a fandom name or not. Fishies? I don't know. I'll just make it up. But she traveled all around to see fish. And I talked about seeing Nine Inch Nails and Dillinger and all the traveling that we've done. And she was like, oh, but I really don't see you as a music fangirl. And I'm like, bitch, I am, and so are you. Like, what are you if not a music fangirl? So it doesn't really connect for some people, even other fangirls, even other music fangirls, the concept of enjoying music passionately as something that's legitimate in the overall spectrum of fandom. And I kind of get that disconnect because the word fangirl has a particular connotation, and it's usually misogynistic and it's usually pretty sexist. And at least until the past 5 years, fangirl was seen as nothing but a pejorative. When I started the Learned Fangirl 10 years ago, people didn't know what it was. Like, people, I had to define what a fangirl was when I explained it. Now people get it, but they automatically think, oh, Marvel Cinematic Universe, oh, comic books, oh, Star Wars. But they don't think of fandom as being something other than geeky. But even within that, when teenage girls or when girls or women are involved with fandom, it's always marginalized, and it's always seen as something that is hysterical or uncritical or not legitimate. Like, you can be a fangirl of a boy band, but you can't be a fangirl of a metalcore band or a classic rock band. And if you are, you're a groupie. You're not a fan. You're not a real fan. You're driven by hormones. You're placed in a hierarchy that is not quite a real fan, but something just a little bit less. Like, to be overly excited about music is to not be critical, and it means that you're too emotional and your actual critical taste can't be trusted. And that has gone far, far back as the Beatles, as Duran Duran, One Direction, now BTS. You have, like, a whole generation, several generations of teenage girls liking things and critics saying, you suck, you're taste or critical. All you want to do is sleep with these boys, and all you want to do is scream and yell about them, but what you have to say about them critically or musically doesn't really matter as much as we do until we decide that the bands that you like are worthy, like the Beatles, like Duran Duran. And if you are into music that girls aren't supposed to like rock, like hip hop, whatever, then you're doing it to impress your boyfriend. You're doing it because you're trying to be a tomboy. Somebody had to lead you to it. You didn't come to it yourself. I've been a fan of heavy music and heavy metal for more than 20 years. And still, to this day, I get asked who introduced it to me. And for me, it's the double whammy of being both black and a woman that people assume that some white boy in my midst introduced me to this music and it wasn't me. So it's something that fangirlness and being a music fangirl, there's a negative connotation to being a music fangirl that hasn't been shaken for some reason. But at the end of the day, we can look at older groups, like I mentioned, the Beatles and Duran Duran, and they are seen now as legitimate groups that now critical music fans like. And in that case, teenage girls are tastemakers, were and are tastemakers, and are usually way ahead of the curve when it comes to pop culture trends and liking things before it's, you know, acceptable to like them. And they're a good judge of quality in the long term. Maybe the Beatles did kind of suck at first and got better and better and better. Yes. my sister is a hardcore Durani. And one of the things that she talks about all the time, and she's still salty about this and will bitch about it today, that when she was into Duran Duran, Rolling Stone, all these magazines were like, oh, they're just pretty boys, blah, blah, blah. Some of these same critics now will talk about how great John Taylor is as a bass player and all their fantastic songs. But 30 years ago, they were just seen as, you know, pretty boys with disposable music. But she liked them. She thought they were cute, yes, but she liked them for their music and talked about their music and was critical about their music. But that wasn't seen as legitimate until, you know, I have a theory about that, so if I can, like, go into a tangent for a second. I feel like a lot of dude music critics, they get mad. They get mad when they see the hot dudes that they weren't in bands getting laid. And so they write snarky ass shit about the dudes. And then when those dudes get old and they aren't necessarily getting laid the way they used to when they were 20, then all of a sudden they're good. It's a total player-hating thing. I truly believe this. but there's also a detachment that comes with music. And to be a real music fan, to be a real, you know, to be critical about music is to never be truly enthusiastic. You can like something, but it'll be like, especially with metal. With metal, it's like, oh, I kind of like this band. Oh, how many times have you seen them? Oh, 50 times. And dudes in metal do this all the time, where they'll be like, oh, they're kind of all right, and I've been obsessed with them for like 30 years. And it's like, well, no, they're not just kind of all right to you. You love them. You love them. You're borderline obsessed with them. You like they're like the blood in your veins. Just say it. Just say it. But that detachment in music is something that makes you critical. It makes you legitimate. And especially in rock music criticism, it's something that makes you, you know, accepted. Like, that's Pitchfork's whole thing, is that everything, even if you really like it, it could be like a 10-star rating. It'll be a 9.5, and they'll be like, it was all right. It's like, no, it wasn't all right. You loved it. Just say that. but fangirls, I feel like one of the great things about being a fangirl is that we don't play cool about that kind of stuff. We like what we like, and we love what we love, and we scream what we scream about, and we love it all, and we're honest about it. And part of what is great about being a younger fangirl, and if you ever get that opportunity to be a part of fangirl culture, especially with music, you get to just lose your shit about something and just love it, and love it with reckless abandon, and have that be okay. And you don't have to play it cool. And you end up being tastemakers in the end by default because you liked it before it was cool to like it or critically okay to like it. You just like it. And I think that's a power in fandom, in being a music fangirl. But also, when you grow up, music fangirls of pretty much all ages tend to be the ones who do the work to keep the scene and the community alive, no matter what genre you're into. If you're doing zines or blogs or message boards or whatever. I'm part of a Dillinger Escape Plan fan community. Don't laugh. It's legit, man. And they broke up back in December. And everybody in part of that fan community that actually did the emotional labor work of, like, scheduling the meetups for all these people from around the world who came to these last shows and making sure that there was, like, a ticket exchange for people who wanted to exchange tickets for one day to the next, asking if everybody had a place to sleep that night. Like, all that emotional work was done by the women and non-binary fans. And the last show, when all these big, burly metal dudes are, like, literally crying in their beer, it was the women and non-binary fans who were like, here's a Kleenex, and comforting them. And that's, like, that's the real work. And then, you know, booking shows and all the, like, things that make music communities run, a lot of that's done by fangirls or groupies or whatever you want to call them, the women fans who don't get seen as real fans are doing a lot of the work to keep that running. And it is emotional labor, and it is socialized labor for women and for marginalized people, but it's also work that keeps these communities running that people don't actually see as important, even though they super are. So the idea of being a fangirl, being a pejorative term, is used by men and women within music scenes to belittle what we're passionate about. And just my experience earlier on where I was talking to my music fangirl friend who's like, I'm not a music fangirl. But then later on she was like, yeah, I'm kind of, I have chill girl disease and I tend to do the chill girl, I'm different than the other girls things. And I was like, at least you acknowledge that. Because I think that's important. Like, I think that the idea of being a fangirl as being a bad thing is something that in geek communities has been embraced and that is seen as a good thing and part of a community. But in music fandoms, it's still seen as something bad. Geek fangirls have a place to claim that term, and I don't think that women fans are collectively there yet, even though music fangirls really are like the lifeblood, I think, of a lot of music scenes and don't get acknowledged as that. There was a really good Pitchfork article a couple of years ago, and it was called In Defense of Fangirls. And the writer Sandra Song said at the end, let's stop using the word fangirl to marginalize women. Let's not use fangirl to force women into enjoying what has been vetted as a suitable interest. Let's free fangirl from the relegation of silly and see it for what it is, a serious music fan in the making. But I also add, not just in the making, but now. I'm a grown-ass old woman. I love being a music fangirl. I spent 2 weeks ago 6 hours in line for Nine Inch Nails tickets. I'll travel to another city or country for whoever I like as soon as I get the chance. I have an embarrassing collection of K-pop dolls that I'm actually not embarrassed about and more coming. I can and will frame my concert posters. Half my wardrobe is band shirts. I started a somewhat career in music writing, but I also started one, not two bands because I wanted to make music like my faves. So I'm proud of being a music fangirl. I claim it because it's not just fun, it's also liberation in the form of fun. So love your idols, become your idols, be a music fangirl. Thank you.
Hey guys, we're gonna take a quick break to fix some AV stuff. While that's going on, there are these cupcakes up here. I don't know if you guys like those, but there are boxes of them, and you should come get one. Come get one while we fix the AV stuff. I'm providing a distraction. Okay.
Okay. Let's make sure.
Sounds good. And it's still recording? Yeah.
Test, test, test. Recording. Yeah. Hello. Yeah. Great. Perfect. All right. Oh, and here's your phone.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Did you do the fans thing with the napkins or just Jess and Dave? That's so beautiful. That's so cute.
I think we're good, actually. Yeah. Hello.
Yeah.
Check. Yeah. You guys gonna wanna speak right into that bad boy right here.
Woo! Thank you so much. It wasn't terrible.
Yeah. All right. All right. Say one more thing. Testing. Okay. Great. So. All right. Cool. All right. I think we're gonna start up again. So if you could all settle down with your cupcakes. Yay! Thank you. We got it fixed. Our next reader. Ann Abel moved from Philadelphia to Chicago for 4 months in January 2016 when her husband, Andy, was a visiting professor at the University of Chicago. She discovered this thing called storytelling, and Andy has been commuting from Philadelphia to Chicago ever since. Ann?
I was home alone in Philadelphia with my 15-year-old son, Josh. My husband, Andy, was traveling overseas, and I was feeling even lower than usual, which, trust me, is low. Josh, the youngest of my three sons, is an introvert, an introvert's introvert. Trying to get him to say anything at the dinner table is a story for another night. It was July, baseball season. I was sitting in the kitchen, stuck to my chair and buried in the newspaper, looking for something to lift me when Josh came into the room in his Phillies pajamas on his way to the den to watch that evening's Phillies game. He stopped. My silent son stopped in front of me, and in a low-key, thoughtful Josh voice, he said, "It's funny. Daddy couldn't get tickets to see the Marlins, but I was just online, and the seats are wide open in Miami when the Phillies played there in 2 weeks." Walking backwards out of the room, he shrugged. "In Miami, there are even seats behind home plate, and the Marlins are the World Series champs." Maybe it was instinct, maybe it was impulse. Whatever it was something maternal that had me getting up and following him. When I got to the den, the television was on and Josh was sprawled on the couch, an open baseball book resting spine up across his chest, a glass of ice water within easy reach on the floor. "Josh, let's go to Miami." "What? You heard me? Really? Why not?" "I am not a fan of baseball or traveling, but I am a fan of Josh, a big fan." 2 weeks later, we're driving down Collins Ave in Miami. Beside me in the passenger seat, Josh is tossing a new baseball up and down into his glove. He had brought the glove hoping to get it signed by, so he could put it on his bookcase next to his most prized possession, a ball signed by Phillies first baseman Ryan Howard. We were off to a perfect start. We arrived at the Delano Hotel, a 15-story white stucco owned by Madonna. The white lobby was filled with fit young men in white linen and tiny shorts. After we checked in, Josh waited outside the white gift shop while I went in to buy a paper. As I handed the white uniform cashier my money, I saw behind her on a white shelf penis gummies, peppermint peckers, and gummy handcuffs. My heart racing, I grabbed my paper and steered Josh to our room. Everything in the room was white, except for a Granny Smith apple that was resting eye level on a white metal ring to the left of the door. I wondered if the apple were for eating or decorating. Josh rushed to the safe and locked up our baseball tickets as if they were the Hope Diamond. Then he picked up the remote, plopped onto the bed, and said, "Mommy, can we watch Lord of the Rings now?" I am not a fan of Tolkien, but I am a fan of Josh. And after those 3 hours, all I could say is that a little man finds the ring. Movie over, it was time to go to Dolphin Stadium, getting there 2 hours early for batting practice. We easily found our seats in the near-empty stadium, which were halfway down behind home plate. Josh looked around and said, "Wow, these seats are great." Then he pulled out his pencil and scorecard and opened his bag of peanuts. I could feel the muscles in my body softening. Below us, people were hanging over, reaching out for autographs. "Josh, do you want to go down and try to get your ball signed?" "No, not today. I just want to sit here and watch." So for 2 hours, we sat and we watched. Game time, Josh hunched forward as he always does, pencil in hand. It was an exciting game. The Phillies are winning. The Phillies are losing. The Phillies are winning. Fourth inning, rain clouds came in. It didn't take long for me to go out and sit down on the grimy concourse. I hoped Josh was having a good time. When people started streaming toward the exits, Josh found me and told me there was a rain delay. No Able has ever left a baseball game before the last out has been played, so I didn't even suggest it. Instead, we sat together in silence for 90 minutes. Tarps off the field, we went back into the stadium, and because most people had left, we were able to sit directly behind home plate. At 1 a.m., 2 long hours later, the Phillies lost. I put my hand on Josh's knee and squeezed him. "Oh, that's okay, Mommy. They play 162 games a year. They can't win every one. We have 2 more games, and these seats behind home plate were really cool." The next morning on the way to breakfast, we passed the swimming pool. It looked like a music video, with bronze top bodies posing in skimpy bathing suits around the cabanas. On the way back to the room after breakfast, I glimpsed the blue Atlantic Ocean and its white glistening beach. I love beaches, but I love Josh even more, and it was time to watch the second Lord of the Rings movie. And from what I could tell, the ring the little man had found was causing him problems. Then it was time to head back to Dolphin Stadium. It was almost a repeat of the previous night, except in the fourth inning when the rain clouds came in, it was a downpour. And at 90 minutes, Josh and I are sitting on the concourse waiting for the rain to end. Over the years, I've tried to learn to be comfortable with Josh's quietness, but sitting there watching him roll the ball around in his glove, I couldn't help wondering what he was thinking. I hoped he was having a good time. I hoped he was glad we were here. He looked at me, smiled, and shrugged. After a 2.5 hour rain delay, we went back in. At 1:30 in the morning, the Phillies lost. Josh stood up, gathered his things, and said, "Maybe they'll win one for us tomorrow." The next morning, we woke up early because our third and final game was a day game. I opened the white Venetian blinds and saw nothing but blue sky and sun. There'd be no rain delay today. We got on the car and rushed back to Dolphin Stadium. We sat down in our seats, and almost immediately, sweat was dripping down us, soaking our clothes, and collecting in little puddles around the seats of our chairs. It was 100 degrees Fahrenheit and 80% humidity. It was Miami in August, and it was hot. In a quick 2 innings, the Phillies were down 6-0, and Josh turns to me, sweat dripping into his eyes, and he says, "Mommy, can we leave? They're not even trying." This trip was already becoming a bad memory. His mother had dragged him to Miami in the summer to sit in the pouring rain and the blistering sun to see his team be crushed. Are you sure you want to go? He nodded. I looked at Josh slumped in his seat and saw the ball in the glove in his lap. Okay, but just a minute. And I grabbed the ball and I ran down the steps two at a time to the bullpen. I climbed up on the railing, clutched onto the net with both hands, still holding the ball in my right hand. Please, sir, I called down to a lone Phillies player who was standing in the bullpen. A security guard hurried over. Ma'am, you've got to get down out of that net. I turned back to the Phillies player who is now looking up at me. Please, sir, we came all the way from Philadelphia. Will you please sign our ball? The player smiled. Sure, toss it down. Them's good folks up in Philadelphia. And he signed the ball and threw it back to me. Three at a time, I took the stairs back to Josh. Who is he? Who is he? He seemed really nice, I said, handing him the ball. Oh, it's Jeff Geary. He's some relief pitcher they brought up from the minors last night. But thank you. And we left the stadium. On his mother's watch, Josh had broken the family tradition of never leaving a baseball game before the last out has been played. When we got back to the hotel, I asked him if he wanted to watch the last Lord of the Rings movie. No, I just want to go to sleep. The next day when we got home, I left my suitcase in the doorway. I didn't feel like unpacking. I didn't feel like doing anything. I dropped onto the den couch with the newspaper and pulled out the art section. Josh headed off to his room. I hadn't even made it through the first movie review when I heard his voice. Mommy? I looked up. He was standing in the den doorway holding two balls. In his left hand, he had the Jeff Geary relief pitcher ball I had gotten signed for him. In his right hand, the case with his most prized possession. Would it be okay if I took the Ryan Howard ball out and instead used the special case for our ball? He smiled. Oh, how my heart soared. I thought we had struck out, but we had hit a home run. Thank you.
Okay, rounding out our first half is Jasmine Davila. Oh, is there? Yeah, there is. Not rounding out our first half. Good save. Jasmine Davila has appeared in venues both small and medium-sized, reading in live lit shows like Tuesday Funk, 20 by 2 Chicago, Funny Haha, and Feminist Happy Hour. You can find her on Instagram and Twitter at Jasmine D. Let's give it up for Jasmine.
Thank you. All right. My college friends Francesca and Lily came to town on a weekend in August of 2015. The three of us, joined by my best friend Anne, passed the time shopping and eating and reminiscing about all the questionable polyester dresses we wore in the 1990s. We went to Happy Village on the last night of their visit, immediately finding a crooked table in the middle of the crowded beer garden, kicking back in our wobbly lawn chairs to reminisce under harsh white lights. Now, I love my friends, but I have a tendency to tune them out when the talk turns to married people, things like families and mortgages and car payments. We had just come from 57th Street Books in Hyde Park, and they were oohing and aahing over the appropriately educational books they had purchased for their young children. Being childless, I felt that I had nothing to contribute to this part of the discussion. And as I was about to get up and investigate the goldfish pond, because if there's a goldfish pond at a dive bar, I think you have to check it out so you can say to people, hey, did you know that there's a goldfish pond at Happy Village? And then you can have a conversation about why aren't there more bars in Chicago with water features? I heard Anne say my name. Jasmine. It didn't immediately occur to me to wonder why she was saying my name, because I was just really curious about the goldfish, you see. And then she said it again. Only this time it wasn't just my name, it was a full sentence, a question, in fact. Hey, Jasmine, how's the fan fiction thing going? And I remember wishing, for the very first time in my life, actually, that a great big hole would appear in the ground beneath me and swallow me up. And there in the hole, I would hide while I slowly but surely died of embarrassment. I could even see a little marker, a wooden plaque painted white and decorated with goldfish that would read, "Here lies Jasmine Davila, died of embarrassment, 1976-2015. Because I could think of nothing more humiliating than my supposed best friend telling two of my other supposed best friends that for the last 5 months I have been writing erotic fan fiction. All of my life I've been a writer. Well, maybe not a professional writer, but a really good amateur. And I feel like I've been working on, and I should have been working on something that might actually get me closer to my goal of being a professional. I was supposed to be writing a book, an important book, or at least a popular one, one that I could promote without shame on national public radio. And maybe if it wasn't a book, then maybe a blog post or an essay or a poem or a magazine article that I could maybe try to convince someone to publish or at least let me read out loud to a willing audience. And if everyone liked it enough, then maybe I'd get some money or at least a little validation. Validation that my words mattered, that they could mean something to somebody who was not me, and then my childhood threat slash dream to grow up and become a professional writer would come true. Instead, there I was at the bar, cowering in my chair. And I was stuck because the sweat on the backs of my thighs had glued me to my seat, so I had no choice but to sit there and listen to my friends squeal in delight and watch them clap their hands before they settled down and began to pepper me with even more questions. So how long have you been doing this? Why did you start? Can I read it? Is it really dirty? What's it about? Who is it about? Can I read it? Why didn't you tell us? Where do you post it? Can I read it? Are you going to publish it? Is it any good? Can I read it? Can I read it? Can I read it? No. What do you mean no? It's just us. We're not going to say anything. I looked to Anne for help and she just rolled her eyes at me. Jasmine, she said, it's good. I glared at her. Hey, I thought you said it was funny, but the, payoff took too long. When did I say that? Back in March when you got me drunk at Lost Lake and I let you read one thing on my phone because I was feeling generous and also drunk. Wait, you were feeling generous when you let me read it? Well, I mean, I was sitting in that seat, that chair by the door, the wicker one with a high back, and I think anybody's bound to feel generous when they're sitting on a throne and jacked up on rum. And I wasn't just making excuses. I was actually buying myself some time, for in my head, I was rifling through all the stories I'd written at that point. Was there something in there I was sufficiently proud of, or at least not totally mortified by, to show them? Because it wasn't just about proving I wasn't bad at it, but also I didn't want to reveal too much about myself. They could read it, but could they prevent themselves from reading into it? What could they think about reading the erotic work of their spinster friend who didn't know dick about dick, writing about dick? Could I show them the fun little one-shot about the clown nose and the ping-pong paddle? No. What about the multi-chapter story with time travel? Mm-mm. Maybe the one where Miss Piggy tries to... Definitely not that one. My friend sat before me, frowning and confused as to why I couldn't just tell them the address of the Tumblr where I posted all of this. I mean, these were women who had known me for 20 years, and I couldn't bring myself to share my work with them, so I tried to tell them why. I started doing it because I started reading fan fiction. At first, I didn't fool myself thinking I could write it too. So much of what I had read was genuinely beautiful and complex and engrossing, but not all of it. A lot of it was, fun, short, and quick, and effective, and doing what it needed to do. But after a while, I got tired of reading about the same kind of girl. The hero, the object of my affection and my fandom, was always the same gentleman. It was the heroines, who we call the original female characters, or OFCs, that should have been more varied, but they all sounded the same to me. They all had sleek blonde hair, icy blue or green or blue-green eyes, a generous bosom on an hourglass figure, and a milky complexion that never bruised. Young women who decided on a whim to move to London or Paris or New York City to fulfill their dreams of becoming an actress or a singer or the proprietor of an impossibly adorable cupcake bakery. The OFC and the hero would meet cute. Maybe they reached for the same book at the library or bumped into each other at a movie premiere. They'd fall in love, have passionate, if vanilla, sex, then live happily ever after in a charming flat above the aforesaid cupcake bakery. Now, I would never criticize anybody's fantasy. I mean, I would, but, not to their face. It's just, I like myself. Not all the time, but enough. I mean, would it be the worst thing in the world if somebody decided to write a story where instead of a cute young white girl, your celebrity crush, be it The Rock or DJ Khaled or Elizabeth Warren, or fictional hero like, Peter Pan or that dude from the Evil Dead movies or Poe from Star Wars, would find himself, stuck in the photo booth at Shuba's with a middle-aged Asian lady? Or how about a 30-something Lebanese single mom flirting with Mr. Darcy? Or how about this? A biracial American divorcee falling in love with and then marrying a senior member of the English royal family. I don't want to say that my chosen fandom, my community of fangirl writers and readers, needed me or my voice, but what was the harm in adding a new voice to their smutty, perverted fold? My experience of writing, of producing this kind of work, was still too raw 3 years ago, because I hadn't yet found my voice or defined my style. I needed to establish a rhythm, become consistent, or at least get good enough that what I wrote was free of the tropes and cliches that tended to afflict fan fiction. But I still rely upon certain words and phrases in my work. I tend to use the word wet a lot because, like most people, I do not particularly care for the word moist. And while I have employed many, many, many euphemisms for the vagina and, you know, just that general area, sometimes you have no choice but to use the word slick folds. As for the work of my fellow authors, I try not to let it bother me when they misuse or misinterpret words, even when it seems that they all misuse the same words in the same exact way. Like when describing the act of grabbing a bedsheet or a petticoat or strands of someone's hair, a writer uses the word fist as a verb. As in, Sherlock fisted the sheets when Moriarty began to nibble on his earlobe. But live and let live, I say. Write and let write. Fist and let fist. Despite not feeling ready or of being so new to a discipline that I desperately wanted to master, that night I did eventually promise my friends to let them read my stuff. Though not without a great deal of hemming and hawing, and a trip to the Mr. J's on State Street after the bar for cheese fries and a grape soda. We went back to the Waldorf Astoria where Francesca had booked us into a suite for the weekend to eat our junk food and gossip and laugh long and late into the night. And after the ladies had gone to bed, I sat on the floor, brought up my laptop, fired up archiveofourown.org and looked through my stories. I copied a few links. No to the one with the time travel, but yes to the one with Miss Piggy, pasted them into an email addressed to my friends, and hit send. Thank you. All right, our next reader.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we have Kathleen.
I'm not on top of my shit.
You're just coming up to say hi.
I'm trying to see how you're doing. Are you doing okay?
I'm good, yeah. Pick up for this? Yeah, I'm good. Okay, cool. All right, our next reader, finishing off the first half, is Kathleen Rooney, a founding editor of Rose Metal Press, a publisher of literary work in hybrid genres, and a founding member of the typewriter poetry on-demand collective Poems While You Wait. Kathleen Rooney is the author, most recently, of the novel Lillian Boxfish Takes a Walk and The Listening Room, a novel of Georgette and Lulu Magritte. She lives in Chicago and teaches at DePaul University. Follow her at Kathleen M. Rooney. She's selling books tonight.
What?
Yes, I know. We'll talk about that at the intermission. But yeah, okay, so here's Kathleen.
Thank you so much. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Great. So I am going to talk for a few minutes and then read for a few minutes. And so thanks for having me and coming with me and listening. The sort of story of fandom that I'm going to tell kind of has the aspect of fandom that I think I like the best, which is that when you really, really like something in a fan kind of way, you almost can appoint yourself a detective of that thing, and you want to solve all the mysteries that thing has to offer, know everything about that thing. And so for me, something that I've been a fan of for a long time is René Magritte, the Belgian surrealist artist. Any Magritte fans in the house? I liked the Granny Smith apple in the baseball story because it's almost like a callback, right? Magritte, probably all of you know him and are well-versed in his work, but he, you know, one of his most famous works is the guy with an apple in front of his face so you can't see his face, so I liked that. That seemed auspicious. So back in 2014, there was that René Magritte Mystery of the Ordinary show. Did anyone see it at the Art Institute? A few. So I went to see it, and as I was sort of going through admiring the art, I was also noticing, and maybe some of you noticed, that the placards, the wall texts where the paintings get explained, were really, really good. And about a third of the way through, I realized that the reason that they were so good is that they were written by René Magritte. Bonkers. He didn't write them. as wall texts. They were he's been dead for a long time. They were excerpts of his writing, and they were so excellent that I couldn't believe that I considered myself a fan and didn't own whatever book that this writing could be found in. And so as they funneled us out through the gift shop, I was like, I am going to purchase that book. And it wasn't there. Heartbreaking. So, but it was 2014. Like I said, we had the internet as we do now. And so I thought that there would be nothing, you know, that would be unavailable to me as a consumer online. So even though the Art Institute, I thought, had really dropped the ball, I was going to get this thing that I really wanted. But here's where I got to start being a detective. I started searching online, and I couldn't find the book. There were no used copies. There was no Amazon listing. I couldn't find anything. But in WorldCat, the World Catalog of Books, I found that it had been issued an ISBN number. Any booksellers in the house, right? The little barcode number. Yeah, booksellers. So I knew because of that that it had to have been, you know, his writings. It was for his selected writings in English. So I knew that had to have been a project in the offing at some point, even if this English translation of his work never made it to production. So through more, you know, I'll condense this part because it was exciting for me, but it's kind of boring to describe, like montage of internet searching. So I found at the end of all this that this book had been commissioned, this English selected René Magritte writings had been commissioned by a tiny British publisher called River Run, which was run by this eccentric British gentleman, John Calder, who was a big Francophile. He published Sartre. But he commissioned this, and it was supposed to come out in 1987. But then the press folded. He lost his arts funding. He got really sick, and it just never happened. But this publisher called Alma in the UK had swooped in and scooped up all of the holdings of River Run, including, I thought, maybe this manuscript. So I contacted Alma, and they got in touch with me and said, we might have it. We don't really know. It was almost like a Vivian Meyer situation where you just like scoop up a bunch of stuff and then sort it out later, and maybe you hit the jackpot. But they hit the jackpot because they said, contact this guy, Andre Derval, who is this French guy who runs this Abbey, which is an archive in Cayenne, France. And they're like, if anybody has it, Andre will know. So I emailed Andre, and Andre had it. And it turned out there was one typewritten manuscript of this English translation of René Magritte's writings sitting in this abbey in Cayenne, France. Typewritten. It wasn't scanned. It wasn't electronic anywhere. One copy. And Andre said, you can just come to France and look at it. And I was like, LOL, Andre, my life is not that fabulous, but can you scan it and send it? And Andre said, no. And I was so mad, so I went back to Alma and told on Andre. And Alma said, Andre needs to give that to you. So Andre did. He scanned it and sent it, and it was amazing. And here's the thing, like when you're a fan of somebody from the past, I think you worry because you think maybe this person who I've spent so many years admiring and loving and looking at the work of and obsessing over was like bad. Maybe, not that, I mean, there's bad people walk among us today. But the past especially. And so I was afraid as I was starting to read it that it would be, you know, racist or sexist or anti-Semitic or just any, you know, choose, you know, pick a card of bigotry. But it wasn't. It was great. It was beautifully written. It was funny. It was smart. It was awesome. So long story short again, over the course of doing that, and I had to like, you know, like type it all up because it was in this terrible scanned copy. I fell in love all over again with René Magritte. And I got to have Alma in the UK put this book out, René Magritte's Selected Writings, first ever translation in English. And then I got to be René Magritte's literary agent here trying to find a publisher in the States to publish it. And it made me feel better as a writer. I know a lot of you guys, duh, are writers. So if you feel bad about rejection, Magritte got rejected a bunch too. I would have thought that like me knocking on doors being like, do you want to publish this like long lost René Magritte manuscript would have led to like all kinds of competitive yeses, but it led to a lot of no's. So finally, University of Minnesota Press put it out. So that's out. So I think, I don't know, that's the first phase. That's a talk phase. But I recommend that book, which is not vain of me because Magritte wrote it. I think it's really good. It's René Magritte's Selected Writings. You can get it from University of Minnesota Press if you like Magritte even a little bit. It's wonderful because it's like prose poems and movie scripts and like manifestos and mystery stories. He also really like the figure of the detective, so that's cool. But I don't have that here tonight. what I have here tonight and what I'm selling for $15 is this book called The Listening Room, which is letterpressed by Spork Press. But as I was doing, and that's what I'm going to read from to kind of wrap this all up, as I was doing all this research and preparing this manuscript with my co-editor, Eric Plattner, shout out to Eric Plattner, I learned all this stuff about René Magritte's domestic situation, and his art is so weird, but his life was so bourgeois and steady. And one of the reasons is that he was married for almost 50 years to Georgette, his wife. I know muse is not a popular word, but she truly was his muse, and she was educated in art history, and they had this sort of cottage industry. She was indispensable to his practice and his productivity. But they also had this series of Pomeranian dogs. I know. And so that's why there's a dog on the cover. And the dog that they always had a dog, at least one named Lulu, because the name of Pomeranians in French is Lulu Spitz. And so naming your dog Lulu is just like here, naming it Pom. And so every time one Lulu would die, they would get another one and name it Lulu, which is so Magritte. He's so into repetition and, you know, not into aura and things like that. So I just thought a lot about what this must have been like to make this sort of wild and crazy artwork while you were living in this very steady household with always your dog Lulu and always your wife Georgette. So this book, The Listening Room, is sort of like a novel in short pieces, told partly from the perspective of Georgette and partly from the perspective of Lulu. So, and Lulu meant a lot to Magritte too. If you look any pictures of them, whenever they traveled, they would always take Lulu with them. And so there's all kinds of pictures of like Lulu in Venice and like Lulu in Israel. So they were like totally dedicated to Lulu. So I thought Lulu probably had like a theory of mind and could talk. So I'll just read one. This is called La Grande Guerre, which means the Great War. And it's sort of the companion piece to the Apple Face Guy, where it's a woman in a beautiful white dress with a big hydrangea blocking her face. La Grande Guerre. A parasol and a stone seawall and a polished lady clad all in white, ostrich feather hat, fringed purse, silk gloves. Her posture, lovely. Her coiffure, tight. But Meg has planted a flower in front, a blue hydrangea, pom-pomming preposterously. Star-shaped blossoms, facade, what Georgette would most like to see. Is the lady's face as pretty as her dress? But Georgette confesses to Lulu, the Pomeranian, that she likes that her husband has denied them that. The three of them are on a walk to get groceries in the morning after a gray spring rain. The air is hung with a purple smell, lilacs. Some petals on the ground, some still attached. Hydrangeas, though gorgeous, have no scent. Some people, some climates can be too nice, oppressive in their mildness, a mildness unto death. Her husband has a wildness, a perversity without which the conditions of their marriage could become adverse. He can be terse and steady, but he is not without temptation. In line at the butcher's, they hear a woman ask, "For two nice kidneys, please." And Magritte whispers to Lulu and Georgette, "I'm tempted to ask for two horrible ones." Georgette's father was a butcher. As a butcher's daughter, she grew used to the slaughter of animals for food, aware of the cognitive dissonance of reserving certain animals for pets. "Would you ever eat me?" Lulu had asked when he was a puppy. "Of course not," Georgette had said. "Forget about that." But she understood why he'd wonder. When they walked by the American consulate on the way home, Mag is tempted again. "Maybe I'll go in and ask them to do the necessary paperwork to make me the king of America tomorrow." The image is called The Great War, and the glory of the woman's attire conflicts with the violence of her not-so-long-ago era. If Magritte were king, then Georgette would be queen, and Lulu would be a cross between heir and court jester. They have in their family a defiance of common sense. Mag seems staid. Georgette knows, to people outside their isosceles triangle. But he's got his darkness, and he's got his edges. He suffers from what he calls the bizarre affliction, the source of his ills and his melancholic progress, ennui. As their friend Susie has said, he lives it as a metaphysical condition, and about his pursuit of painting, he at times manifests an almost constitutional dislike, feigning something between boredom, fatigue, and disgust. Georgette imagines that if you took the hydrangea away, you'd find the woman to be blind. She looks like the kind to say pro patria and to shut her eyes, stop her ears, and sing a popular song. "Right?" says Lulu. "Like, la, 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 everything's sunny and nothing's wrong." Ugh. Thank you.
All right. Are you ready for some more stories about fangirling? Woo! All right. Let's kick this off with Leanne Yopes. Leanne Yopes, long O in that yo, is a Chicago-based stand-up comedian, storyteller, and writer originally from Wisconsin. We just talked about Milwaukee. It was great. She is your go-to guide for all things 80s and 90s related. Leanne is also the creator of the website BH9021. Whoa! The site is better than a mega burger about everyone's favorite teen drama zip code. And when she's not busy gushing over Luke Perry, she also runs a monthly storytelling show about music called Appetite for Rock and Roll Storytelling. It's really fun. You can catch Appetite every second Wednesday at the Elbow Room at 8 p.m. for a true evening of oral debauchery. I can't say that. Leanne, when is your next show? What's the next date? June 13th. Let's give it up for Leanne.
Hi. Sorry. About a year and a half ago, magic happened. And I met my childhood crush. By magic, I mean that I paid hundreds of dollars to meet a lot of people's childhood crush. In sunny Bloomingdale, Illinois, I went to a hotel and stood in line to meet the one and only Luke Perry. You may know him for his best role, the bad boy with a heart, Dylan McKay, on Beverly Hills 90210. When I was 10 years old, there was a new show on Fox about pretty teenagers who lived in a fancy place called Beverly Hills 90210. They had perms, Steve Sanders, high-waisted jeans, everyone, and on episode 2, a soft-spoken mystery man that some might call a hero, me, confront some bullies in a computer lab. The mystery man was no other than Dylan McKay, the dreamiest of the teens with sideburns. Dylan McKay could surf, ride a motorcycle, possibly impregnate you at the spring fling. This man was everything. But there's a man behind this role, and that man was Luke Perry. Since the time that Beverly Hills 90210 came out, I've seen this show a billion kajillion times, or whatever a Fitbit would call sitting on a couch watching reruns of Beverly Hills 90210. I'd always been a fan of the show, but over the years, the fandom had grown. First, I got my 90210 ankle socks, which I'm wearing. And then fast forward a whole bunch of years after creating a website dedicated to the show, I finally got to meet the Dylan McKay. When my handsomest friend Nick bequeathed, and maybe requeefed, his unboxed Dylan McKay doll, we had our first date, where we met. He cooked me dinner. He fell off the wagon. We spooned and maybe more. Over time, he met my mom. There's so many pictures, I'm sorry guys. He jumped out of a cake on my birthday. He role-played as Dylan Bolton with my discarded hair from my hairbrush. Before the Michael Bolton concert. And we even made our way onto the Steve Harvey show. I'll leave these two. I was randomly asked by someone on Facebook if I would be interested in being a part of the Ask Steve segment. As someone who loves seeing herself way more on national TV in a free makeup job, I submitted some questions, with one of them being about finding a real man while I date a doll man. Steve Harley quickly licked his lips and told me no. but not without putting a fake gun in his mouth and pretending to shoot his brains out. Not shown on TV. The doll version was great and all, but I too wanted to meet a real man, and that was Luke Perry. A friend sent me a notification that Luke Perry was coming to Chicago. And by Chicago, the convention meant Bloomingdale, Illinois. I called my trek the Woad to Luke Perry. Originally, when this convention was mentioned, I saw that I could meet the majority of the original cast of 90210. But along with that, there is Zach Galligan from Gremlins, as well as Jeremy and Jason London. Who's who? I don't know. You should ask my friend Aline, who went up to their table and they said, you can look at our table and see which one we are. Some of the cast of Growing Pains, including real-life Ben Seaver, Tracy Gold, because I remember her real name and not her character name, and Alan Thicke before he died. If this wasn't enough, the convention also had appearances by ABC soap stars, boy bands like O-Town, and lesser-known members of the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. Still not enough? This convention had the janitor from The Breakfast Club slash the oily bohunk from 16 Candles. And real-life Kenny slash real-life Brad Keith Coogan from all of those babysitting movies of Adventures in Babysitting or Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. I died and went to 80s, 90s heaven in 3 days. This convention was straight up my nostalgic heart. The week leading up to the convention was the week that Trump was elected into office. My friend Alina and I watched old episodes of Beverly Hills in preparation, and we were checking our phones for election results. As the night went on, I yelled at one of my cats more than usual because I couldn't believe what was actually happening. The next day was somber as fuck. The whole week was really dark, but I was lucky enough to have a distraction, and that distraction was Luke Perry. This was the first convention I went to. I mean, sure, I went to auto shows as a kid, where I met the gorgeous ladies of wrestling and Bo from Days of Our Lives. But this is the first time that I stood in line to meet a celebrity of my own childhood dreams. If you've never been to a convention before, they're weird and really expensive. You pay for everything. You meet these celebrities, but it's very small interactions. Before meeting Luke Perry, I stood in line for 40 minutes to meet Tori Spelling, to not actually meet her because she left for lunch. But don't worry. Because the next day I got this picture where she eyed me up and down and said, cute dress. And then I told her that I got ready that morning hoping that she would compliment my outfit because I have no game. She responded, mission accomplished. Oh, Tori, still not going to buy your makeup or belly fat shakes. After Tori left her table, I moved over to James Eckhouse's table. James Eckhouse played Jim Walsh on Beverly Hills 90210. We were talking about how the dad from Ferris Bueller almost got the role of James that James was cast as. And we both just were so happy that it went to him. Then I gazed into James Eckhouse's eyes and forked over $20 for a blurry selfie. Because when else would I have this opportunity? Because I'm also terrible with money. During all the standing in line for Tori and James, Luke Perry was within sight, but I wasn't ready yet. I had to mentally prep after stuffing my face with McDonald's. In addition to selfie and autographs at the celebrity tables, there's also fancy photos available in a special room with a backdrop. The time had come to get the fancy picture with Luke Perry. As I approached him, I shook his hand because I'm a professional. Then Luke Perry, the Luke Perry, said, we hug. And then I cream my tights. We smashed faces and took this gem together. Later in the day, my friend and I met Jason Priestley, who played Brandon Walsh from Beverly Hills. He is a shrimp. This is one where that I didn't realize how small 5x7 actually is. He stood on his tiptoes right before this pic was taken. At the end of day one, there was a Beverly Hills 90210 panel. The cast answered questions from the crowd. Someone asked their favorite lines from the show. Jenny Garth, who played Kelly Taylor, said, "I choose me," from the iconic episode where Kelly finally became self-reliant, which only lasted that episode. Then the cast asked the audience what their favorite lines were. I raised my hand, and Gabrielle Carteris, who played Andrea Zuckerman, called on me. In front of the cast of Beverly Hills 90210 in a room full of strangers, I proudly said, "Have a good time at the gynecologist." As my favorite part of the entire series is when Brenda Walsh tells Emily Valentine to have a good time at the gynecologist. Real-life Emily Valentine, Christina Lise, shot out of her chair and cheered. So here's the pic of Christina Lise and I having a great time at the gynecologist. I made a sign, yeah. She actually didn't know what it said when I got this picture taken and then found it later on Instagram. But after the panel, Luke Perry was chatting with his fans. I went up to him again and said I was going in for another hug. Then Luke Perry, said, "Well, I'm giving them." And I'm sure you can all guess what happened in my tights at this point. On day two, I felt far more confident and went right up to Luke Perry's table. I told him about how I date the doll version of him and showed him the pic of Dill jumping out of the cake. He joked that his butt really looks like that. And then after that, I went into the fancy photo booth to get our picture taken with Jenny and Jason. As we were waiting, I saw that Luke was in the photo booth too. And I told my friend that maybe, just maybe, Luke could be in the picture too. I walked into the photo booth and had a bit of an awkward encounter with Luke Perry when he gave me a look that said, "Here again." And then I said, "I'm actually here for Jenny and Jason." Burn. I sidled up next to Jason and he asked if we wanted Luke in the pic too. The universe, guys. It was listening. And then we got this pic where it looks like he's trying to cop a feel. Ooh, wee. After that weekend, I felt that my life was complete. But since then, I had drinks with Christina Lise and her mom at the Signature Room. I'm on Keith Coogan's Christmas card list. And was even in the same room with Jason Priestley again in New York for a panel for his new TV show, Private Eyes, where someone recognized me, which was kind of weird. But as if all of this wasn't enough, it was announced this past January that Luke Perry was coming back to town for a Riverdale convention. His new show about the Archie comics, yeah. I couldn't wait to stand in line to meet Sir Luke again. We were going to be reunited, peaches and herbs style. A month ago, I joined a bunch of teenagers in Rosemont, Illinois for Riverdale Con. I made a sign with pics of Luke Perry and Skeet Ulrich that said, "I'm here for the dads." This convention was much different because although I enjoy the show Riverdale, I don't really care about it as much as Beverly Hills 90210. I have standards. No, I do love it, actually. Day one started off with a Q&A with Luke Perry. I was so excited. I ran to the mic and said, "Oh, hey, Luke Perry. I'm here for the dads." And then he said, "Hey, I'm back. Be still, my heart." And then I said that I wish that the writers on Riverdale would occasionally throw in Beverly Hills 90210 quotes for us oldos. And I said that my favorite line from Beverly Dillon line was, "May the bridges I burn light the way." And I asked Luke Perry what his character would say if Archie said to him, "May the bridges I burn light the way, Dad." And then Luke Perry, said, "Get a match." And then we both threw our heads back and laughed. Shortly after, I stood in line to get my fancy pic with Luke Perry. I was grinning from ear to ear. I gave my childhood crush a big ol' hug again and said, oh, hey, Luke Perry, we've met before. And then we took this pic together that looks like we're the best real estate team in town. This cost me $70. Later in the day, I went up to Luke's table and we got to talk a bit more. I said that we had met at RewindCon, and whether he was being polite or genuine, he said that I looked familiar. And then I creamed my tights. We talked about our Canadian friend Darren, who is best known as the 9021 bro. Luke Perry took out his phone and showed me a stamp with his face on it that he didn't know that existed until Darren had shown it to him. Then he let me take this picture of him with my very own phone.
I thought I had these in order, I'm sorry.
But look at this, guys. Up close and personal. And then he ruined my $50 picture by posing with that stamp again. But no, it's a cute picture. It's all right. But the beauty of Facebook is that then you can update these things and put Kiss Cam on it. At this time, I gave him my Luke Pun Christmas cards. And said he was going, and he said that he was going to hang them on his tree because his kids would get a kick out of them. As he read the cards that said, "I hope your holidays are more than lukewarm," and it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, I said I like to make puns out of his name. He said, "I can see that," and then gave me the best compliment in the world, and complimented me on my MS Paint skills. I asked if he would quote the next one, and he said, "We're looking good." Not bad, Luke Perry. Not bad. After chatting with Luke, I stood in line to get a fancy pic with Skeet Ulrich, mostly so that I could caption it, "Skeet, skeet, 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 motherfucker. Skeet, 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 goddamn." As Prince's Kiss played, I hugged Skeet Ulrich, and then we took this pic together where it looks like we crashed all of the proms. All of them. That cost $60. I ended day one by attending Skeet Ulrich's Q&A. I didn't ask any questions, but someone asked him what role he identified with most, and he said that it was some Hallmark movie. I'm telling you this so that you also now know this completely useless knowledge. Day two got off to a shaky start, as I almost missed the fancy pic with Luke Perry due to an medical emergency on the blue line. But don't fret, because they still let me take a pic for another $70. This moment, though, was so good. This is one of those things where, for some reason, I was meant to miss the original time slot, because then as I walked up into the photo booth, Van Halen's Panama was playing, and Luke Perry was singing along while drumming on the wall. Gasp. Does Luke Perry even know that my alter ego is David Leanne Roth? All of my worlds were colliding. I told him that he looked adorable, and then we took this pic together. God, we really are Luke and good. I ended day two at Luke's table, where I forked over even more money for one last picture. He was originally standing on my right side, and then ran around to me saying that this way that the dog would be looking at me. I said that it looked like the dog was checking me out in the other pic. Then Luke Perry, the Luke Perry, belly laughed at my lame joke. I thought to myself, this isn't even my A material. After he stopped laughing, he said, "Him and everyone else in those polka dots." I couldn't cream my tights fast enough. But then I got this picture for $50 with our heads touching. That's our engagement photo. But so now April 29th, 2018 goes down in Yope's history as the day that I made Luke Perry belly laugh. and more importantly, the day that Luke Perry checked me out. And then now I vowed to update any of my online dating profiles to say that Luke Perry has checked me out as I sit home alone and watch reruns of Beverly Hills 90210. But I want this to be a lesson to all of you, that you too can meet your childhood crush if you pay hundreds of dollars to meet them.
Okay, the product of 9 years in San Francisco and 8 years in St. Paul, Rosamund Lannon is pleasantly surprised to have lived in Chicago for over a decade. During that time, she has been published by internet periodicals, performed stories around the city, and consumed many carne asada burritos. These days, she's pretty into speculative fiction, co-hosting Lady Liveless show Misspoken, and trying to write essays that make you feel things, think things, or at the very least, laugh.
I met Neil Gaiman when I was 14 years old. Someone got crushed by that, but I'll keep going. He was doing a signing at Dreamhaven Books and Comics in Minneapolis, which was just over the river from my parents' house in St. Paul. And I was a regular at Dreamhaven. I went there as often as my paper route money and the Lake Street bus allowed. And it was at Dreamhaven that I bought my first Sandman comic. So a tiny bit of backstory. Sandman is a comic that was written by Neil Gaiman and published by Vertigo, which is DC Comics' alternative line. It tells the story of Dream of the Endless, a godlike being who rules over the world of dreams. It's pretty much the greatest thing ever. Yeah. And so I'd always liked comics. When I was a kid, I read Batman and Superman and Betty and Veronica. And as a preteen, I poured through my parents' copies of Mouse and Mad Magazine and old issues of the Funny Times. But Sandman was different. Here was a comic worlds away from capes and cowls and wholesome teenagers or even snarky political punditry. This comic, Sandman, it had fairy tales and real people and a family as mythical and dysfunctional as my own. There were kingdoms within subways and fairies hanging out in diners and witch women making everyday magic. I was in love. I bought the first trade and then the second trade and then slowly amassed the whole series. And after Sandman, I moved on to Neil Gaiman's novels and short stories, Neverwhere, Angels and Visitations, The Day I Swapped My Dad for Two Goldfish, tales old and new and weird and real. It was exactly what I wanted, like what I didn't know I needed. I felt like Neil was writing just for me. And from the beginning, he was Neil. It felt like we were on a first-name basis already. So I got to the signing an hour early and walked anxiously around the store. There were a lot of goths, and I felt very uncool. I'd worn my black tank top and long black skirt, but I couldn't help noticing that I was more of a beigey paste than a chalk white. Not ideal. I had that feeling, as one often does when they're 14 years old, that I shouldn't be there, that I was too young, that I was too stupid, that I had too much color in my cheeks. And then a dark-haired man entered the store and began to set up. He was pale and thin and wore black jeans and a black t-shirt. I recognized him instantly, and also his face was on the back of the book that I held in my hand. My heart shot rays of adoration across the room, and at some point my feet followed. I shuffled forward and placed a stack of books on the table. Neverwhere, Preludes and Nocturnes, that issue of Cicada, which featured his story Troll Bridge. And at the top of this stack was 999, which you've never heard of, but it was a horror anthology, which was the reason for the signing. See, the date was 9999 in honor of the book title, get it? Like 999? 99 was also my birthday. It was my birthday, my golden birthday. I was meeting my hero on my golden birthday. Okay. So before we launch into the greatest moment of newly 14-year-old Rosamund's life, I want to make it clear that I'm not going to do a British accent. Yes, Neil Gaiman is British, but no, I'm sorry. Accents give me PTSD from guys that I dated in my late teens. And yeah, no accent, so just live with that. I slid my books in front of Neil. Hello, he said. He smiled. I tried to smile back. Hi. Oh, Cicada! I forgot that I did that story for them. I'm so glad you liked it. I nodded, and I died. For a week after the signing, I floated. I wanted to sleep for a week and dream of our 45-second exchange. And I feel the need to mention, in light of current events, and by current events I mean things that have been going on forever but are just now coming to light, that it is not confusing or difficult for a grown man to act appropriately around a young girl. Be nice. Be kind. Don't make it sexual. When you are still forming as a person, it is everything when your hero treats you with decency and respect. And I'm not giving Neil Gaiman a medal, you know, for just being a baseline decent person, but it did mean a lot. College. A friend of mine was, get this, Neil Gaiman's personal assistant. His name was Cody, and he mentioned it casually, and I lost my mind. I wanted to know everything. And I found out some things that I already knew through the mid-2000s internet. Neil Gaiman had a history with Scientology, but was no longer part of it. Neil Gaiman had 3 children. Neil Gaiman lived out in Menominee, which explains why the Wisconsin scenes in American Gods were so good. I found out some things that you probably can't find on the internet, at least not without some legwork, and I'm not going to share them, because you know what? Being famous doesn't mean you want your business aired at a live lit show. And the tidbits about Neil Gaiman's life were fascinating, but honestly, they kind of dampened my crush. He was like a real person with a wife and kids and a house, and to me, at 17, that was not very sexy. And eventually, my feelings about his writing waned, too. Like, throughout college, I continued to read his books, recommend them to friends, and go to signings, but honestly, I kind of started to lose interest after American Gods. I wasn't that crazy about Anansi Boys. And I felt guilty for not liking it more, like I was betraying a lover. And I mean, Coraline and the Graveyard Book were pretty good, but honestly, eventually I didn't really seek his work out. Around the time the Graveyard Book was published, Neil Gaiman began dating Amanda Palmer. Amanda Palmer is the lead singer of the Dresden Dolls. Amanda Palmer did a TED Talk about how it's really cool to ask people for money. Amanda Palmer reminded me of every art school girl that I ever wanted to punch. I'm sorry if you like Amanda Palmer. I found out that they were dating through the internet. It was some photo shoot they did together, and then I clicked and clicked and clicked and read and read and read until it was verified. This was the only way I would have found out, because I don't actually know either of them, or their friends, or run in any of their social circles. Cody was the closest I got to Neil's personal life, and ironically, like, again, that sort of killed it. Like, once Neil became a real person, poking into his affairs felt exciting, but also felt kind of gross. But disapproving of his romantic choices, totally okay. I was not a fan of Miss Palmer, but there wasn't that much I could do about it because it was 2008 and the internet as we know it was still pretty young. Like, let's think back to 2008. Twitter was in its infancy. Instagram was a twinkle in someone's eye. Snapchat was so far away. It was not as easy to get minute-by-minute updates into people's intimate lives. Like, these days, I know practically by osmosis what Chrissy Teigen had for dinner, and the oxtails and coconut rice looked amazing. And I mean, it's fun, right? Who doesn't like getting a sense of a person whose work you admire? But it's also kind of weird. Taking a deep dive into a creator's personal life is now effortless. It provides perfect fodder for a fan base who believes that a steady stream of information gives them the right to comment on and rail against creators' choices. And like back to how Neil Gaiman was totally not a creep and a really nice person, I want to be very clear that I am not talking about Me Too. Sexual abusers should face every consequence, not just fan backlash, but like every legal consequence, and maybe they can be thrown into a volcano. I don't know. I'm talking about decisions that may be unpopular, but are not in any real sense of the word wrong. Unless fans treat it that way. And I want to be clear that, like, this isn't an internet thing. This behavior is not new. For as long as there's been celebrity, the fans have had reactions. In the 1960s, fans freaked out when Bob Dylan picked up an electric guitar. In the 10s, a riot greeted the debut of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. In the 1900s, Arthur Conan Doyle was forced to bring Sherlock Holmes back from the dead after readers lost their shit. Fans have always been weird, but there is something about the 24/7 access provided by the internet that creates a false intimacy between fan and creator. This idea that you, as a consumer, have a say in another person's work or life. For example, Essie Hinton, author of The Outsiders, was asked by fans on Twitter if two of the characters in her book were gay. She responded honestly, "No, that's not how I wrote it." They dragged her for months for not making their fan theory canon. Steven Universe fans bullied an artist to near suicide for drawing a character by their approximation too skinny. When Robert Pattinson began dating FKA Twigs, some fans were horrified that he was not dating Kirsten Stewart, his Twilight co-star. Their ship not only never came in, but crashed into the very real-life iceberg of Robert Pattinson is a grown-ass man with free will. Not a conglomeration of your weird and racist fantasies. And, like, this kind of behavior, it's not love. It's not even fandom. It's a mob. And I get it, you know? Like, when I was 14, I was very lonely. I had bad skin and not a lot of friends and a not-so-great home life. Neil Gaiman's books were my escape, and what an amazing escape they created. They were a trapdoor and a ladder. They got me out, and they got me through. And he, the man, was really nice to me in a time when the world did not seem very kind. That means a lot. However, it does not matter that I think Amanda Palmer is corny. It is okay that not everything Neil Gaiman wrote spoke to me in the same way. It is fine that I unfollowed him on Twitter because, oh my God, he tweeted a lot. Like a 16-year-old girl, you guys. Oh my God. My opinions about him and his work are valid, but they do not mean that my thoughts about his wife, his work, or anything else should really hold any kind of weight. I am not his family, his creative partner, or his close friends. No amount of reading someone's books, creeping their Instagram, or favoriting their tweets gives you a full understanding of them as a human being. I can tell you that Neil Gaiman was born in Portchester. I can wax poetic about his platonic romance with Tori Amos. I've read The Sandman Companion cover to cover. It doesn't mean I get a say in his choices or that I should throw a tantrum when it doesn't go my way. Fandom isn't about that, or I don't want it to be. Being a fan means having something that means something to you, as well as many, many other people. That's really beautiful, and that's really magical, and most of all, that's real. All right, our last reader of the night, Megan Kirby, has written for Jezebel, Bitch Magazine, the Chicago Tribune, and Bust. She runs a storytelling and zine-making show at Delilah's called Meanwhile. It's super fun. You make zines, and then you show them, and you get them at the next show. The next episode of Meanwhile is on July 31st. She's written fanzines about X-Files, The Neverending Story, They Might Be Giants, and more. Give it up for Megan.
Hey, guys. Hi, I'm Megan, and I like Harry Potter. Like, I really like Harry Potter. Like, if you ask someone about me, chances are one of the first things they'll say is, oh, Megan really likes Harry Potter. Like, for 6 months, my Tinder profile just read, talk to me about Harry Potter, which resulted in some weird messages. But the truth is, I've been feeling a little off lately. It's not just that J.K. Rowling should have her Twitter taken away, or that I don't want to bankroll Johnny Depp by seeing the new Fantastic Beasts, or that my review of Cursed Child is just one word, and that word is, huh. These things hurt, but I'm not sure it's a shift with Harry Potter itself. I kind of think it's a shift in me. When I was an awkward kid, Harry Potter gave me a way to connect with the outside world. See, I'm not always sure if people will like me, but maybe they'll like a thing that I like, and then we can talk about it. If I didn't know how to talk to people, I could always just ask them their Hogwarts house. But lately, that feels a little lazy. I'm not sure I want to be Harry Potter girl anymore, which is a real thing I went by in college. Yeah, not great. Even at the time, I was like, maybe not. But after 20 years of building my identity around everyone's favorite boy wizard, I don't know where that leaves me. So let's look into my personal pensive, the moments in my Harry Potter memory that have defined me as a person, and the hopes that in mapping it out, I can figure out where I'm going to go next. I am 8 years old, and my hands shake, my eyes ache. Before recess, I approach my third grade teacher's desk. Mrs. Ray, I say, please, please finish the book today. I have to know the ending. I can't sleep. Tomorrow is Christmas break. Oh, no. And I don't know what I'll do if I leave Nicholson Elementary School without hearing the end of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Mrs. Ray says she'll try. And then she fails. At the end of the day, she calls me to her desk. Promise me you won't ruin the ending for anyone else, she says, as she slips me the hardcover book. I solemnly swear. Then I rush home, read the last four chapters as fast as my cognitive abilities allow, and immediately call Amber B on the phone to tell her Voldemort was hiding out on the back of Quirrell's head the whole time. I am 11 years old, and the line snakes around the corner of Naperville North High School. My mom and I have been waiting for 3 hours. We have 3 more hours to go. Inside, J.K. Rowling signs book after book. I know her name is pronounced Rowling, like Rowling on Molly, and I know the K was added to her pen name to make her seem more legit. By now, when it comes to Harry Potter, I know everything. The girl next to me in line tells me she's read Sorcerer's Stone 32 times. Keep in mind, it hadn't been out that, like, what, 5 years? When she asks how many times I've read it, I shake my head. So many, I say. Can't count. I know the answer is 12. Shameful, shameful, 12. In 180 minutes, I will say 3 words to Joanne Rowling. Hello? Thank you. In 240 minutes, I will get home and begin rereading Sorcerer's Stone. When I reach the last page, I will flip to the front and start over. I will not be bested again. I am 17, and Harry Potter is 17, and that is perfect. By that, I mean that it is the summer before my senior year of high school, and the final book is coming out. Nothing in my life has ever been this important. Nothing in my life will ever be this important. My friend Mia and I are in deep. We alienate all of our friends, even the ones who like Harry Potter, as we hang out at Mia's house carving wands and charting Marauder's maps and talking endlessly about how Remus and Sirius are fucking, like, definitely, like, for real. I attempt my reading of Deathly Hallows in one gluttonous sit-down. I gasp, I pace. At one point, I literally throw the book across the room and then run after it. When I'm 2/3 of the way done, my mom sits across from me at the kitchen table and takes my pulse. My heart races like a hippogriff who hasn't been shown proper respect. Okay, she says, you need to drink some water, and then you need to go on a walk. We take our Labrador Retriever to the dog park, and the whole time I stare at the world through glazed eyes. I go home and sit in the backyard and finish the book just before the sun sets, and it's perfect. It's perfect. Except for the epilogue, which we won't talk about. I am 19, and the synthetic beard itches my face. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince premieres at midnight. I am in an oversized brown coat, a pair of my dad's scuffed boots, and a bushy brown Party City beard. I carry an umbrella with an ornately carved handle. Outside the movie theater snack bar, a group of preteens gather around me. "Hagrid! Hagrid!" they chant. I raise my umbrella over my head and yell, "First years this way!" as I march towards the theater. My college friends are horrified. When the previews roll, I don't take off my beard to eat popcorn. This is a mistake. I am 20, and my mom wants a Sprite. I get it for her from the mini fridge, then settle back into the vinyl hospital chair with Prisoner of Azkaban on my lap. Mom doesn't talk much when she's at chemotherapy. She sits back with her eyes closed. That summer I moved back to help out with her treatment. I reread a lot of my childhood favorites, Chronicles of Prydain and His Dark Materials and Narnia, and of course Harry Potter, my childhood set of dog-eared pages and broken spines. This summer, I stick on the times when Harry feels tired, when he feels afraid, and when he keeps going. I'm struck by the fact that he's just a teenager. Just a kid who never asked for the weight of the wizarding world to be put on his shoulders. I'm 21, and I trust the apprentice at the suburban tattoo shop. I get the spell for light, Lumos, tattooed on my rib cage. A week later, the tattoo blows out. Now I have the word lumps tattooed on my rib cage. It's cool. I like got over it. I think it's funny now. You guys can laugh. I am 28, and I am driving my sister's Hyundai Elantra to a zine fest in Milwaukee. Like usual, I am talking just to talk. I just feel sort of distant from Harry Potter, I say. Like, maybe I'm outgrowing it? The person in the passenger seat turns to me with both eyebrows raised. "Megan," they say. I look down. I am wearing a Harry Potter crew neck. The Harry and the Potters album, Voldemort Can't Stop the Rock, plays over the car stereo. I say, "Oh." But maybe outgrowing is the wrong word. Maybe I'm just growing. I'm surprised by the amount of changing I've done in my late 20s. I thought once you hit 25, you were just locked in. Turns out that's not true. I find myself wanting new things, but that doesn't mean I'm going to leave all the old things behind. I'll carry Harry Potter with me always because I don't really have a choice. But I don't have to wear it like a name tag. For 20 years, I've used this boy wizard as a security blanket, something I can pull over myself whenever I feel in over my head. And it's kind of scary to realize I don't need to do that anymore. Lately, I've been thinking about what I like most about myself. And I like the part of myself that loves things so deeply and loudly. Underneath the Hot Topic t-shirts, the weekend-long Wizard Rock festivals, the 50,000 Harry Potter fanfic I wrote, the distractions of fandom, the core is that I let myself care about things very much. And that isn't just true about teenage wizards. It's true about my friends and my job and my apartment, my artwork. It's true about my whole life. So hi, I'm Megan. I don't really want to be known as Harry Potter girl anymore, but I would still really love to hear about your Hogwarts house. Thanks.
All right, super quick.
Super quick. Hey, there's comics on the table. If you like comics or someone you might know likes comics, you should take them. The cupcakes are from Blue Sky Bakery on Lincoln and Roscoe. They're amazing.
The stickers, again, were from Minuteman Press. And I think that's about it. Like, well, yeah. I guess that's just our show.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah. And please join us in thanking tonight's readers, Keidra Chaney.
Woo!
Anne Abel. Woo! Kathleen Rooney. Woo! Leanne Yopes. Woo! And Megan Kirby.
Yay! yeah. So we would also like to thank the Gallery Cabaret and you, the audience. You're pretty great too. Give yourselves a hand. You can find out more about us at miss-spoken.com or listen to past episodes on iTunes or Stitcher. Please come and see us again next month on Wednesday, June 27th. The theme is
Miss Manners.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Should we do the raffle?
Yeah. Okay. Did we get any?
We did announce. Oh, we're terrible. I'm terrible.
Oh, okay. I thought we were.
If you have written on your badge, on your Lady Live LitCon badge, if you could take a moment and bring it up here and put it in this, and then we're going to mix it up, and then we're going to draw, and someone's going to win a prize. Oh,
yay!
My God. It's all of Leanne's pictures. Just kidding.
Want to read all of them or just
yeah, let's read all of them.
Like, super quick. All right,
guys, we're gonna read through these and the last one wins.
The last one.
Oh, wait, is that how it goes?
Or do we want to have people to vote? Maybe.
No.
No.
That would take too
all right,
long.
Fine. Last one. Okay. All right. We're not gonna read everybody's. We will read the name of the person who wins, though.
We'll read the
so.
Name of the person who wins.
Okay. So first one is in middle school. I was a Statue of Liberty's greatest fan. Aww. I dyed a bedsheet Kelly green, built a crown and torch out of cardboard. I went to school in full costume to Halloween of 1989.
Statue of Liberty.
That's
yay!
Awesome. Okay. Had a total stranger take my picture as I held a 750-page hardcover book outside Anthony Trollope's house in London near Marble Arch.
That's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. It's pretty deep, too. Okay. What did I do? Oh, 5,000 fanfic bookmarks. Wow, that is a lot. I mean, how do you organize them? Because I need tips, frankly. Okay.
Move on.
Fine. Meeting Bronson. Oh my God, Bronson Pinchot at someplace in Boston, and being asked to leave. No. Being so disbelieving, I made him prove who he was.
Aww.
Honestly, I would have done the same thing. I mean, it is Balky, after all. Okay, road trip 1,000 miles to see Carly Rae Jepsen and Matt Hur and Bob Saget, who also performed. Bob Saget?
Really?
Wow. I didn't know he sang. That's incredible. Okay, none Beverly Hills related, but I once, sent Bret Michaels from Poison a letter telling him that if I was
almost.
Born a boy.
I almost.
Okay, if I was born a boy, my name would have been Brett too. That's a good name. All right. Nothing on Cinnamon's cards. Oh, okay. All right. So, Doctor Who and the Internet, but that's not a thing. Okay. All right. Completely froze and was unable to talk while meeting Conan O'Brien in high school.
That's super deeply fair.
Yeah, really. Bruce Springsteen kissed me and
what?
Got a photo.
Who the fuck is this?
Ann Abel. Oh, my God.
Sleeper hit.
Scandalous. Oh, my God. Okay. still have scrapbook from when I was 13 with pics of Ilya. Oh, my God. Who is that man from Uncle?
Ilya Kuryakov.
I am not going to pronounce that.
Who wrote this? Just say his name.
Ilya Kuryakov.
Thank you. All right. when the cast of Chicago Med was at the annual Planned Parenthood gala, we snapped selfies.
Aww.
And the last one is waiting in line for several hours to get hot dogs before they closed. Aww.
Aww. And you're our winner.
Beth Ann.
Come on up and get your prize.
And I think that's our show.
So this is a $20 gift card to Challengers Comics, which is a really excellent comic book store, which donated the comics tonight and is like 3 blocks away. And if you're going to go buy comics, they're pretty much the best one. I don't care what your opinion is. Go to Challengers Comics. They're great. Thank you so much.
And good night.
Thank you for listening. Visit miss-spoken.com for the occasional update, information on our next show, and how to get involved.